Okay, so thanks again for coming. Just to remind you of a couple of things, the books are for free. We actually get them from Wat Metta, which is a Buddhist monastery. And please, if you're interested in them, I'll try to bring more as the weeks come. But please feel free to take them. If you have a mind to help us pay the rent, that's what the basket is for. Your money definitely helps keep us. It's the only thing that keeps us in this space. I don't take money for teaching, so it all goes to that cause and to supporting the school in India. But if you don't have money, please don't worry about that. Lack of funds should never, ever get in the way of access to a Sangha or to hearing the Dhamma. And if you can help, of course, at the end, shift the blankets and the cushions. And I think that shelf is still leaning, so be mindful of that. Don't want that to fall. Might not want to stack things on it. Okay, so for the next month or so, or probably more, I'm going to be giving a series of talks starting tonight on the Buddhist teachings, which are specifically helpful psychologically, is self-contained teachings that are filled with tools that help us deal with everything from obsession to worry to anxieties, fear, you name it. So we'll be going over these various talks for the next period. And tonight, rather than starting with the simplest, because that would be the easy thing to do, I thought I'd start with one of the most famously challenging of the Buddha's teachings, and I think it's one of the most interesting. It's certainly packed with a lot of really helpful tools for dealing with, basically dealing with emotional baggage, dealing with the unconscious impulses that flood the mind, take it over with everything from overwhelming urges that get us into trouble to all sorts of mind states that create havoc. So this is the Sabhasava Sutta, the second teaching in the Middle Link Discourses, and it's one I've been studying for many years. And there's a lot of online talks by different monks about this. So if there's anything that is unclear tonight, you'll find a lot of talks online about it. I know that Bhikkhu Bodhi has one online that takes 6 hours. I know because I crawled through it this weekend. Don't worry, I won't be talking about it for 6 hours. I'm giving you the highlights. We'll be done with it in a half an hour at my end, at least. Okay, so starting right off. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha made an observation that about 100 years ago, a psychologist basically seconded, which is the mind is not a single thing. It's not a single thinker. It's actually made up of various different subsystems or parts. It's more like a committee, or if you have it, a machine made up of different parts. For example, some different views of it, Freud said that there's the ego, basically your primary thinking. Then there's the superego, which is the internalized voice of societal rules, often your parents' voices internalized and other teachers and the law. And then there's also the id, your unconscious impulses. Freud said that was made up of sex drives, and then later on he added the drive towards death, or the thanatos drive. And there's many other philosophers and psychologists who've gone on and elaborated the different ways they think the mind is made up of conscious and unconscious elements. For example, if you're a Marxist, you might state that while we have a conscious life, we are also manifestations of class struggle, and that each one of us is, without our awareness, articulating the views and opinions of either the proletariat or the bourgeoisie. And we might not be aware of it, but it's coming out through us nevertheless. So you get the idea. It's not that what we think is everything. There's more to it. The Buddha said that there was basically, in every given moment, there were at least five parts to who we are, not one. There was not only the thoughts, but there was the body sensations, just the way your body feels. There's the gut feelings, how where you carry your stress in your body, that thing that lets you know when you're anxious or when you're feeling positive. Then there's also perceptions, and then there's also consciousness of the senses, smell, taste, what have you. So there's all these different parts to what's going on in any given moment. Now, beyond that, the Buddha also said that there are these unconscious impulses that are beneath the surface of our awareness, and they're lingering there. And when certain things we make contact with triggers them, they bubble up to the surface. These are unconscious impulses, asavas. They're spelled A-S-A-V-A-S, asavas. Now, the word means literally in Pali, which is the language that the Buddha was recorded in, it literally means to ferment something. Something steeps and then bubbles up to the surface. It becomes an extract or a secretion. It's not the greatest term for unconscious impulses, but whatever. I'm not going to argue with the Buddha. So he used asava for his phrase for unconscious. And so he stated in this sutta that there's actually a way to restrain these impulses that take us over and can, like, take over the mind and push us around. Sometimes they push us in a good place, but often they push us to do things rashly without thinking them through. Now, there's three basic kinds of asavas in the Buddha. The first is kamasava, K-A-M, asava, and that's lust, sensual craving, desire. And you all know about that? I don't think I have to tell you what lust and craving is. If I do, talk to me afterwards. So kamasava, that's whenever something, a lust for sensual pleasure, overwhelms the mind. It doesn't only have to be sex. It could also be just seeing something that you just have to have, that just takes over the mind with desire and craving. I sometimes will walk through an Apple store and experience kamasava. then there's bhavasava, which is craving for more existence. Doesn't only mean to live on, words, it can mean that, it does mean that. It also means, though, wanting to achieve a new state in the future, where, you know, when you hear people say, when I get that degree, I'll be able to quit my job. When I become a, when I'm retired, then I won't have to worry about all this stuff. When my kids move out and I'm, you know, no longer have to pay for them. When I'm, whatever. There's this when I'm idea that we put off our happiness towards, and that's what bhavasava means. It's this idea that sometime in the future there's this other state that we can get to where we will be happy, and it's this great urge to keep on going so that we can get to that place. Then there's avijasava, A-V-I-J-J, and that's ignorance based, and what it really means is mostly it means self-centeredness. When we view everything that happens in terms of ourselves, when we go through things in life and we think it's all about us, that nobody else is experiencing it, that if somebody breaks up with us, we think, why me, when everybody goes through breakups, everybody's been dumped, or when we go through loss, and instead of just feeling the feelings, we go through all these thoughts, why do I have to be the one that experiences loss? Because everybody experiences, as the Buddha taught, death. So there's this tendency to go through life and experience everything personally, and that's a delusion. That's an ignorant point of view. When we immediately make that jump, why is this happening to me? When virtually every experience that has happened to you has happened to millions and millions of other people. It's just the mind's tendency to take it really personally. So these are the three forms of impulses that flood to the surface of the mind. Sometimes somebody will say something hurtful, and immediately this defensiveness and why are they always picking on me will jump to the mind. That's avijjāsava. It's this sense of I'm always being picked on. I'm a victim. I'm the one who's been, you know, who's had a harder life than other people. So you get the idea. This is one. On the other hand, you might walk down the street and see somebody who's really attractive, and then bang, you're in kamasava. And then you might be in a situation where perhaps something, you might get some bad news, and you might have bhavasava. You can't wait to get to that next state in life where you won't have to worry about such news, or you can get to a better, safer, more financially secure place. So all these asavas jump to the surface, and the Buddha gives a talk about what we can do. So he says, the foundation of working with the asavas is a mind practice called, and this is one of my favorite words, so I'm probably going to say it a couple of times until you beg me to stop, yoniso manasikara. Yoniso manasikara. It's spelled Sikara. Manasikara. Yoniso manasikara. It means wise attention and reflection. Looking at what we experience from a wise mind and reflecting on it, as opposed to looking and using our minds incorrectly. So we have to practice yoniso manasikara. And when we do practice yoniso manasikara, we start doing really two things. We start noticing what things are good in the long term and what things are not good in the long term. Not short term, long term. For example, taking crack probably feels good in the short term. Shooting up dope feels probably great in the short term. I never shot it up, so I don't know that for a fact. When I was younger, did other things with heroin and crack and all that stuff. But I can tell you in the short term it's good. Long term, not good, right? Okay. So we're talking about what's good in the long term. Okay, so clarify that. So that's one of the things about yoniso manasikara. That's my favorite phrase, and I can't even say it. Another thing is noticing what conditions make things arise and how you can get rid of them. And the Buddha gives a whole teaching on it. So here we go. The seven ways of yoniso manasikara. The first is yoniso katori. And when you use yoniso manasikara, by the way, you get to a place which is another great word, yabhata manasikara, which means seeing things as they actually are, not seeing things distorted, but seeing things as they really are. And we'll talk about what that means. How do you see things as they really are, not distorted? So the first way is, the Buddha says, in the first of the seven, is you practice wise seeing. And the way we do that, he doesn't mean seeing literally visually, he means experiencing life wisely. And what he means by this, he gives some very specific examples. I'm going to read them because I think they're very clear. As examples of inappropriate thoughts, he lists Who am I? Who do I take after? What's going to happen to me? What was I like in the past? What will I be like in the future? What will others think of me? You get the idea. These are the kinds of thoughts that we think a lot, right? Me, 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 me. I. We tend to experience all of life, or a lot of life, from this grid of I. What does this mean to me? What is going to happen to me? Is this really me? We tend to have this pattern-seeking mind that immediately, whenever we have an experience, we tend to turn it into this large statement about ourselves. For instance, we make a mistake, or we don't get a job, or we're at a job that where we made a mistake, whatever. And we think, oh, why do I always fuck up? Why am I never going to find a good job? Why am I never going to be happy at work? Why am I never going to be in the perfect relationship? Why am I never going to have a good relationship with my parents, etc., etc.? We can take experiences or tendencies, and sure, they might happen a lot, but we can blow them out into absolute statements that don't allow for any contradiction. One of my favorite examples of this was a therapist I was talking to, a friend of mine, and he was telling me about his work with a patient who called him up and said, or an analyst or a client, I guess they call them these days, you're no longer patients, you are now clients of a therapist. And the client said, I am such an angry person. And my friend, the therapist, said, well, are you angry now? And the therapist said, are you angry now? And the guy said, no, I'm not. And the analyst said, well, that means you're not an angry person. It just means you're a person who's capable of being angry. But if you are an angry person, you should be angry all of the time. If that's who you are, you should be angry right now. But if you're not right now while you're talking on the phone, all that means is that you're somebody who has angry tendencies. You're angry maybe a lot of the time, but it's not who you are, because there's times when you're not. It's very important to make that clarification, because when we do, we're no longer trapped, right? We can give ourselves permission to not be angry when things happen that we don't like. But the moment we start saying, I'm an angry person, we indebt ourselves to become angry when things go the wrong way. On the other hand, if we say, I'm a sad person, we indebt ourselves to become saddened when things go the way we don't want. So selfing, making statements about who we are, the Buddha is pointing out, creates this entrapment. We're forced into these niches, and we don't give ourselves permission to have the possibility to react in a different way. Okay, so now you might ask, okay, if selfing, or if looking at it in terms of what does this mean about me, is not the way to think, what is the way to think? And the Buddha goes on to say that. He says, what are appropriate thoughts? Simply this. This behavior causes suffering. This behavior doesn't cause suffering. This thought causes stress. This thought doesn't cause stress. In other words, look at everything you're doing, and instead of asking, is it you, or what does it mean about you, just ask yourself, does this thought, when I think it, bring long-term happiness, or does it bring long-term suffering? You don't have to bring whether it's truly you, that thought. In fact, if you bring self into it, you say, this is the kind of thought I think, you're trapping yourself. But if you simply say, when you're going through worrying about your financial security, and you say, step back from your thoughts for a second, you give the thought a little bit of space and you ask, when I think about my financial future, does this ever bring clarity or does it generally bring anxiety? Then you can notice, you can achieve a sense of yabhata manasikara, seeing that thought as it really is. It's not a thought that brings clarity. It's actually a thought that you use to beat yourself up with, to cause stress and suffering. So that's basically the foundation of the seven, knowing what kinds of things to focus the mind on and notice what kinds of things not to focus the mind on. The rest of the six are actually the Buddha's just going out and listing what kinds of things we shouldn't be focusing on and what kinds of things we should. For the second group, he says we should practice not marrying ourselves to our senses, our seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling. We should learn in our meditation to be able to defocus on certain sensations. So if they are causing unwanted results, we can switch from one sense to another. If what you're looking at is causing you trouble, you can switch to another sense. Now, most people think this is a great idea because we want to immediately jump to avoiding the looking at the uncomfortable things in life. Like, oh yes, I don't like looking at homeless people. This is a great idea, what the Buddha is teaching. No, that's not what he's teaching. He's actually generally telling us when it comes to craving here, remember. In these root impulses, the Buddha actually doesn't list aversion. He's talking about craving. So when he talks about turning off the senses, he means when it comes to cravings, to desires. When you're overwhelmed with lust for something, you might want to look away from it. You might want to focus on something else. So then you ask, okay, that's something that he's saying that I shouldn't focus on, or should learn to be able to turn off. What's something to focus on? And the next group is, he asks us to reflect on how we're using the four requisites, which are food, clothes, shelter, and medicine. So instead of focusing generally on all the other things we focus on sometimes, the Buddha says a safe thing to think about is, how am I using in my life food? Am I using it appropriately or inappropriately? Am I using it to just, he says at one point, feel good? Or am I using it basically to keep the body healthy? Clothing, am I using it to keep the body warm? Or am I using it also as a sense of creating happiness for myself? If you're venturing into the latter, the problem is that it's fine to buy nice clothes once in a while, but if you think it's going to bring you lasting happiness, your wardrobe, believe me, you're in trouble. Okay. Likewise, shelter. If you think that getting a nice house or apartment is going to be the answer to a lot of your questions about what's the purpose of living, or why am I here, or how can I find happiness, it won't. I'm here to bring you the bad news. On the other hand, we're not supposed to completely not use these things either. The Buddha is saying use these things appropriately. Use food to keep your body healthy so you can meditate and that you can exercise so that you feel good. Use clothing appropriately. Use shelter appropriately. And use medicine appropriately. A lot of people, when they take a meditation, they immediately want to throw away their antidepressants. If that thought is running through your mind, please don't do that. Please. Please, I cannot tell you how many times I've had people come to me and tell me that they want to use this to jump off their medications. And that's, I mean, it might very well be part of the course that will help you in that realm, but no, this is not meant to be just you're immediately launching off into a medication-free environment. What we're trying to do is use medication responsibly. Okay. Now, the next group is sort of fun because the Buddha gives some funny lists in it. It's tolerating the things that we generally often get irritated by, and avoiding, though, the things that will cause real suffering if we don't avoid them. So there's a balance here. The things that we're supposed to tolerate, he lists things like mosquito bites, feeling a little cold or a little warm, feeling, and he really focuses on, though, unwanted remarks by other people. Wow. How many times do we all, I'm not coming across as like I'm, we all get thrown by some remark. And part of this practice is, again, learning what to focus the mind on. So part of tolerating is simply seeing, okay, if I let myself become defined by what people say to me, or if I attach my happiness to what people say, I'm going to suffer. So I've got to learn to practice not to be thrown by the shit that people say to me. It's not attaching. It's looking away. It's focusing on other skillful thoughts. If you find yourself pissed off by something that someone has said, find something more skillful to think about. If worse comes to worse, if you have to address it, first get to a place where you're physically calm, relax, that try to work through forgiveness and then talk to them about it. Not from an angry place of getting even, but from a calm place of explaining that such remarks are hurtful. But the first part of the practice is not to overly focus on something that has caused you suffering. Probably by the time you're repeating it in your mind, you've already gone through the suffering enough. It's just overkill when you're repeating it. So, and my favorite list, which I'm going to read because it has to be heard to be believed. This gives you an idea of how old Buddhism is. Here are the things we should avoid. We should avoid wild elephants, wild horses, wild bulls, wild dogs, snakes. This gets really good. We should avoid stumps. That's tree stumps. That's when you're walking around. I once was walking. Me and a friend were so drunk back in the early 80s. We were walking in a field that had only one tree, and we both managed to walk right into it. So avoid stumps and trees, bramble patches, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspool, an open sewer, reflecting appropriately, one avoids sitting in unsuitable seats, wandering into unsuitable habitats, and this is the serious one, one avoids associating with all sorts of bad people. So while we don't focus on little irritants that happen in life that are unavoidable, like mosquito bites, unwelcome remarks, we do focus on avoiding things that will cause real lasting suffering, like a wild elephant, a cesspool, a wild boar, or a fucked up person. Okay. These are actually, back then it was probably helpful to be reminded about the wild elephant, so scoff as ye may. Finally, the last two are crushing thoughts, which basically means replacing thoughts that will cause harm. Anytime you have a thought about causing harm to yourself or another person, that's the kind of thought really to crush. And next week when I talk about the five ways of getting rid of obsessive thoughts, I'll go into the five ways of getting rid of harmful thoughts. So that's next week. That's my cliffhanger. So tune in again next week. But again, any thought that might cause harm, just switch away to it. Switch away to it. And what sorts of thoughts we should cultivate, those are the seven factors of enlightenment. And it will take too long to tell you all seven of those. It's like a group of seven talked within another group of seven. I will say, though, that one of the keys, and we'll have a whole talk on this too, is practicing mindfulness, which is cultivating an awareness at all times on what's going on in your body. Knowing when your body is getting tense, when it's getting tight, when you're getting physically upset. If you can focus some of your awareness through your life on keeping your body, the parts of your body that hold stress, relaxed, the chances of you falling into the effects of the asavas, the impulses to harm or to act out of lust in ways that get you into trouble, or act you out of ways of craving that get you into trouble, or whatever behaviors you have that tend to turn out poorly, if you focus on relaxing the body, the chances of acting out through addictions is much diminished. So many of the people I've known who are addicts and alcoholics who have picked up over the years, so many of them are because they get to a place where they're not capable of relaxing themselves. They get to a place where they're so physically stressed that the only way they know to turn off the mind and the body is by using. And if we can develop the skill to relax the body, we have won so many of the battles and challenges of life. So start noticing where you carry your stress physically, and start practicing using your breath, your awareness, your senses of goodwill, your compassion, to see if you can make your body a place where your mind can reside in comfortably, rather than a place where you're desperate to stay away from. It's when we're so uncomfortable in our body that we get angry and we hurt other people and we hurt ourselves. So that's tonight's talk on the 7 ways to deal with unconscious impulses. Next week is the 5 ways of dealing with obsessive thoughts. Now it's your turn to ask any questions about anything I've talked about tonight. Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for the talk. I've looked at a little bit of Hinduism, and one thing I really like is this notion of samskara. It's like these ingrained grooves in our minds that it's like all this thinking over and over and over and over creates these, like, I don't know, almost like tracks in our head. And then when we lean into those samskaras, when we lean into those grooves, there's a way, by taking opposite actions or not acting out, we actually, there's a way, like neuroscience, there's a way to pop out of that.
Right.
And I like what you were saying, because it kind of, I don't know if there's a similar thing, but the bubbling up, the fermenting of, it obviously there's some sort of percolating, fermenting equipment that we have in our mind, this periphery of our heads that creates this thing to happen. So for me, just to hear that, it's good for me to hear that, because I think, you know, so many of my behaviors, it's like watching a horror movie where it's like, don't go in that room.
Yeah.
I don't walk into that tree, and I do. And just to know that there is a watchfulness that can happen. And then, but that's why meditating is so great for me. It's a blessing. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. A couple of notes. In the Buddhist teachings, sankhara is means more fabrication. It means anything we add to the present moment. Some sankharas can be good, like adding a sense of appreciation to how it's great that you came to meditate tonight. On the other hand, you could add a negative sankhara when you're meditating and say, oh, why can't I stay more calm? So that's a sankhara. It's just anything we add to the present moment, anything with our mind. The Buddha had a phrase, anusaya, and that means mental ruts. And there's, I believe there's 7 of them. But they basically contain all of the mental habits that we fall into, and that's the sense of, there's a sense of ruts or tracks that the mind falls into, the Buddha taught that. Once we get in them, they're very, very hard to get out of. It's like when you're steering on a wintry road with snow and you've gotten into the tracks. If the tracks lead off the cliff, you're in trouble because it's very difficult to steer off them. I use also the analogy of, you know, the easiest time, you're in a subway station, you don't jump on any train that's going on in any direction depending upon when it comes in first. You generally like to know where that subway is going. But many of us, with our own minds, we just jump on whatever thought comes in. We have no idea where these thoughts are heading. We don't notice if the thought, what's going to happen to me in the future, generally brings us happiness or if it brings us stress. We don't notice if comparing ourselves to other people's careers brings us happiness or if it brings us stress. All these things I'm using, by the way, these examples are not good ideas. We don't notice if, you know, thinking, what do people think about me? We don't notice if that question leads to good results or bad results. Generally leads to bad. So it's important to notice when what this whole teaching is about is giving us some advance warning what kinds of subway cars to jump onto, reflecting on how we use food and clothes as fun, reflecting on how we can avoid causing ourselves lasting suffering is fine, reflecting on what things we do cause stress and suffering is fine. On the other hand, the kinds of thoughts that get us into trouble are, what does this have to do with me, why me, what's going to happen to me, that kind of stuff. So those are the train cars not to get on.
And I think what's so great about that is that the mind, for me, is like a dog that just sees what it wants to go through, and then regardless that it's Broadway, it will jump out of the traffic and just goes. And for meditation, I think that's where you get the little piece of space where then you can choose the subway. Because without that little space, it's like I don't even know I'm in a subway station. I'm just getting on the first car I see.
Absolutely. It's called, psychologically in cognitive therapy, it's called detachment, which is simply that ability to stand away from thoughts and look at them before we become part of the bubble and float away in the bubble of the thought. And the way you do that is by keeping awareness of the body. That's the thing that gives you the most space away from your thoughts, because when you're in your body, you're grounded in the present moment. It's very hard to be tugged away if you have an awareness of what's going on with you physically. That's why in the Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha first taught, go again all the time, first into the body. See what's happening. Keep yourself grounded. Then you can look at the thought and ask, is this worth thinking or not? But always go back physically into relaxing the body, keeping the body comfortable. Thanks. Hi.
When you were talking about the, I guess you started with the food clues and then the negative remarks, you talked about, if somebody said something negative, I understand that. Then I was thinking about, if somebody praises you, or, you get to, good job, well done, the positive remarks, that, and then if you noticed your body, you'd probably be like, I feel great, but then that's also, I guess when you're, cultivating creative towards praise, you still really have, I just was wondering how that fits in with what you were talking about.
You bring up, it's a great question. In one of the teachings I'm going to give, the eight worldly winds, which is the things not to attach to, two of the worldly winds are praise and blame. And the idea is if you become hooked on when people give you praise, then you're going to be fucked up when people give you blame. So it's best not to become attached to either, because if you're looking for your sense of self-esteem from what people say or think or how they regard you, then you're going to be in trouble when you're not in their highest opinion. The Buddha said there are people who will criticize you if you talk too much. There are people who criticize you if you talk too little. There'll be people who criticize you if you talk just the right amount. So basically you can't win, right? So if you're trying to get your sense of self-esteem from outside, don't do it. Now, I'm not urging people to turn into George Bush and go into war, regardless of what every other country in the world thinks. That's not the idea. The idea is to have first a peaceful moral foundation that's based on not causing harm. And so long as you follow those precepts of not causing harm, you don't have to overly depend upon what people think. Now, exactly. If you attach to praise, you will then suffer when blame happens. On the other hand, the Buddha does teach in the Brahma Viharas to cultivate appreciation. Now that means appreciating your own acts. It doesn't mean depending upon other people to appreciate you. It means rewarding yourself internally for when you do something skillfully. So instead of being, a lot of times in life when we do something good for another people, when we're earlier on in our spiritual development, we run around. We tell other people, you know what I did today? I gave a dollar to a homeless person. I helped an old woman across the street. And I held the door open for a person who was on a walking chair, you know, to get into the elevator. And the problem with that is it means that it doesn't count unless we get other people to know. So we're making our sense of self-esteem contingent upon other people knowing the good deeds we do. We're making ourselves still dependent on other people. But if we can feel a sense of inner self-esteem just for ourselves, knowing that we've been helpful without needing to tell anyone, then our happiness is no longer contingent. So that's the difference between inner appreciation versus attaching to outer praise and blame. I hope that was... Is that okay? Oh, great. Thanks. Hi.
I'm troubled by the idea that we're not supposed to, or it's not skillful to focus on our future self. I assume that everybody in this room is here because we want to become more skillful, compassionate, calm. Mm-hmm.
That's a great, another great question. Tonight, everybody's swallowing the bowl. I don't know what you all... great question. The Buddha is simply saying not to try to figure out exactly what your future is going to look like. It doesn't mean not to want happiness for yourself. In fact, the entire point of the practice, the Buddha says, is to create future happiness. So the thing we're doing is actions right here and right now that we know will plant the seeds for future happiness. But if you try to figure out what that happiness will look like in the future, then you're drifting off into unskillfulness. Because the Buddha says that the specific outcomes of karma are unknowable. You know that if you act selflessly from compassion, appreciation, from a sense of equanimity, that you're planting good seeds in your garden. You know that if you act out of anger and jealousy and envy, whatever, that you're planting weeds in your garden. Now, that doesn't mean that you should sit there and try to imagine what your garden's going to look like exactly in the future. That's asking what will become of me. It's trying to mentally picture what the future will be like. The Buddha says that there's no reason right now why you can't be happy. It doesn't matter what's going on in your life right now. You have the tools to be happy because you have a body, you have a breath, you have a mind that's capable of appreciation and compassion and kindness. So you can achieve happiness right now. So the need to say, to engage in bhavana asava, which is saying my happiness is only capable in the future, is not true, right?
Actually, I don't really believe that.
You don't believe that you can be happy right now?
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. You don't.
It requires a lot of practice. My dad just said to me recently, he's like, sitting is like rubbing two sticks together trying to get fire. You can let them for 10 minutes and then stop and then the next day do more and it's not going to start fire unless you continue doing it. So if I sit down right now, I'm not going to reach my goal today. But another point...
No, it's fine. It's good.
I've heard it said that when you go to sit, you should not have any intention. Not really intention, but expectation, perhaps. You should just sit for the purpose of sitting. And it's so hard. Every time I sit, I'm like one step closer. You know, it's hard to not think about why you're doing it and the goal.
both points I can only answer from the Buddha's teachings in the Pali Canon. And believe me, when the Buddha says feel free to disagree, really, feel free to disagree. And that's totally, the Buddha in the Kalama Sutta says disagree, put everything to the test, and so you're under no obligation to agree with any of this. The first point is the Buddha does say that any breath can be the breath that can bring you to a sense of release. So you might not believe it, but the Buddha does believe that in certain circumstances, even though we don't believe it, if we have the right attitude, the right intentions, we can actually experience a moment of great release, even though our minds might say, no, it can't happen. I understand that for lasting enlightenment, it takes years. But to drop into a state of samadhi and to the jhana state can happen at any moment, and it can happen at times which are completely unlikely. I've fallen into places of great release and calm in the subway, practicing just standing meditation. So I just would suggest experiment, wait, see what happens in your practice, and if it doesn't happen for a while, that's fine. You know, the goal is, yes, to get to a place where we can draw out the enlightened stages for long periods. But you might, at any given moment, fall into one of the jhanas, the states of absorption. Even in an early state, I've known people who in the very first weeks of meditation have fallen into the jhanas without very much experience. It's taught that the Buddha, when he was six, fell into the jhanas, when he was the first time he meditated. So it's up to you in your experience to discern that. Really, don't believe what I'm saying. Follow your own experience. Now, with the latter, whoever says just meditate, don't have a goal, that's ridiculous. I mean, Ajahn John says over and over, Ajahn Jeff says over and over and over in his teachings, as does many other great monks, that the goal of all the Buddhist teachings is to find liberation from suffering. And that should be the goal. There's no word, believe it or not, in Buddhist, in Pali, for acceptance. There is a word for appreciation. And yes, we should try to appreciate what's going on in our meditation, but the goal is to achieve peace of mind. That's what the goal is. And that's why the Buddha, in the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, which I'll give a whole talk about, the second factor is analyzing, what is going on so that you can make it more easeful and relaxing, so that you can guide it towards its goal. It's a very new 20th century idea that meditation should just accept whatever happens, that there's no goal to it. And it's absolutely not true from what the Buddha taught. Every single part of the Buddha's teachings says that meditation should be heading towards peace. That's why we're doing it. That's why it's called bhavana, which means mental development, developing it towards something. So I strenuously disagree with whoever said the second. Keep an open mind. But there's another great monk who said that he didn't, I think it was Ajahn Mahabhu, who said that he didn't achieve lasting peace for years and years and years, and then he fell into it and became one of the great Ajahns. So there are some people who get it very early, there's some people who get it very late, and I believe that a lot of our views are, you know, just from our early experience. We might find it very difficult at first to quiet the mind, but that doesn't mean that our minds are useless. It might mean that we're very good at the analytical part of seeing which kinds of thoughts cause us suffering and which kinds of thoughts don't. My co-teacher and I, for years, Craig, he was much better at falling into the jhana states than I was. But I thought I had like a mind that was very good at analyzing what kinds of actions and behaviors were causing myself stress and suffering. So you can't tell. Thank you. All right, one last question. All right, we have two more. And then, so you first and then in the back, and then we'll be done.